Hello, I am John Cryer, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. The first episode of our new series, Brilliant Disguise, focused on the, well, shall we say, unique eyewitness identification procedure used to identify a 21-year-old man named Ronnie Long. Suspected of a minor charge of trespassing, he ended up being convicted of rape and burglary and has served over 41 years in prison. So with us today is Colin Miller. He's one of the hosts of Undisclosed and a law professor and associate dean at the University of South Carolina School of Law. How you doing, Colin?
Great, John. How are you?
I'm having some technical difficulties, but other than that, pretty good. Also with us is Valina Beattie. She is a law professor and the director of the West Virginia Innocence Project. Before coming to West Virginia, Professor Beattie was an assistant United States attorney in Washington, D.C., and a senior staff attorney at the Mississippi Innocence Project. Thank you so much for being here, Valina.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So, okay, I got to ask, and we had very few district attorneys on the show. The last time we had one, it was, it was one of my favorite episodes, actually. It had a little bit of controversy, which was fun. But I wanted to ask you, what drove you to become an ADA?
Good question. I actually was a rape victim advocate in college, and I was a domestic violence counselor. And that work was really rewarding, but I ultimately felt like it was a Band-Aid for the problems instead of stopping the perpetrator and stopping the crime from occurring again and again. So that's what drove me to go to law school and ultimately what drove me to become a prosecutor, to be able to prosecute domestic violence and sexual violence offenses. And once I got into the job, I realized it was just not a good fit for me. And when I started prosecuting drug offenses and drug distribution offenses, I really just started to see that I was a cog in the wheel of a system perpetually putting poor people of color and predominantly men of color in prison. And that's what I was doing every day, was standing up and being part of sending these men to prison. And it didn't feel like I was doing much justice, ultimately.
Did you feel like you saw systemic things that you wanted to fix?
I felt like, people always say prosecutors have so much power, but I was in such a big office that I didn't feel like I had the independence to make decisions about individual cases. Or if I saw that there was a really weak case, I didn't feel like I had the discretion to dismiss it and to really talk to the defense about a case. And ultimately, I really did just see myself as standing up every day in these sentencing hearings, because so many of the cases plead out. And what is the state's recommendation for a sentence? And that's what I was doing day after day after day. And it was ultimately demoralizing.
So how would you feel pressure that you couldn't, say, drop a case that you felt like the evidence wasn't strong enough? I mean, I always assumed that that was literally, that's under the purview of an ADA, correct? Or is it
You are absolutely right. But I wasn't there long enough to rise through the ranks to be in a position to make those decisions. So I would take them to my supervisors. And if my supervisors said to go forward with a case, then that was my obligation, was to go forward with it.
So what brought you to the Innocence Project?
Unhappiness with, with
the my point being, what made you say, ding, the Innocence Project is where I should go, as opposed to getting out of the business and just following Jimmy Buffett around the country?
Right. Yeah. Or I'm joining legal aid and doing women's rights work. Exactly.
Yes, there you go.
So I had a friend who worked for the New Orleans Innocence Project, and he loved it. So I would call him and I'd be walking back from court, you know, end of the day, you know, dragging my big suitcase with all of these cases in them, just totally defeated. And he would tell me about this great work he was doing out on the road, investigating cases and meeting clients and tracking down witnesses. And it just sounded so alive and meaningful that I decided to throw in an application to the Mississippi Innocence Project, which was crazy. I was in Washington, D.C. I'd never lived in the South, let alone the rural South. I lived in Nashville, but that's the Mid-South. But I thought, why not? And I'm never actually going to do this. And then I went down for the interview, and I was down there a few days, and they actually took me to meet an exoneree, LeVon Brooks, who was an amazing man. And I met him at his mother's funeral. So LeVon had been in prison for many, many years, and his mom had always supported him and stood by him. And then I think it was less than a year after he was released, she died. And I thought that was so unfair. And he said, you know what? She was able to lay down her hammer. She fought for me for years and she didn't have to do that anymore. Like, she could be at peace. And meeting him and meeting his family, that was the moment when I just realized this was the direction I wanted my life to go in.
Well, we see it in so often in these cases that the most painful things for the wrongfully convicted are missing their families and you yeah. know, having that whole part of their life robbed from them. Yeah. You know, I mean, people still assume that, you know, you can still, they're still visiting and people can still write, but, you know, not being able to go to a wedding or a funeral, or, you know, a funeral is even worse, you know, it's not being able to pay respects. That's one of the things that touches me about these cases, and that Ronnie Long has been in jail for 41 years. I mean, that's right. almost twice the length of time that he was free.
Right.
You know, he was only 21 when he was first arrested. It's kind of mind-boggling. Actually, Colin, I had a question. So part of the reason that we suspect that Ronnie first came to the attention of the police in the Juddie Bost case was the previous case that had happened a year before in Washington, D.C. I was curious, did the jury ever hear the evidence about that first incident?
Yeah, they didn't. And that's interesting, I guess, on two counts. So the first is, this would be considered character evidence. It's evidence of another incident, not the one charged in this case. And of course, he was cleared in the investigation. So there's not evidence connecting him to that other crime. And therefore, that evidence is inadmissible. But what that leaves you with, on the other hand, is this sort of gap at trial where you wonder, well, how exactly did he become the suspect in this case? Obviously, the police are arranging this in-court identification where they think that Ronnie Long is the suspect. And you just wonder the thought process of the jurors, well, how exactly did he get on the radar of the police? And obviously, if they had learned of this prior incident, that might have hurt his case some. But you wonder, was it actually maybe even more difficult for Ronnie Long when the jurors are sitting there and thinking, there must be something we're not hearing? Was it a failed polygraph test? Is there something else that didn't make it into evidence? So, yeah, that was not part of the case at trial, and we don't know exactly how that played out with the jury.
So, yeah, I've found in my experiences on juries is that the gaps are often as big a deal as what's there. I was a jury member on a civil trial where there was an incident that occurred that an EMS technician was there and witnessed and, you know, and provided aid. And yet they never called that person to testify, even though he was clearly the best person to have judged what had happened in the particular case. And so all of us were trying to ignore the fact that that person hadn't been called and hadn't, you know, we had no idea what was said or, you know, what they witnessed. But we knew that they had the information, and for some reason it wasn't being presented to us. So as much as we wanted to not to just care about what we saw before us, we couldn't help but wonder.
Yeah. And there's this famous study. There's this rule of evidence, Federal Rule of Evidence 411, and each state has a counterpart that says evidence concerning liability insurance is inadmissible. And the primary reason is, if you think about sort of a classic negligence case, car accident, etc., if the jury knew the defendant had insurance, they're thinking, oh, it's the insurance company paying, not the defendant, and they're much more likely to find the defendant liable. And so 411 says this evidence can't come in, but the sort of classic study of juries finds, despite this evidence not being admissible, inevitably jurors start talking about, you know, does this defendant have insurance? And what does that mean in terms of his liability, how much he'd be paying out of pocket? So, yeah, it's really interesting to see what jurors might actually consider, even if that evidence isn't being introduced at trial.
So the episode was really about how strange it was that the police officers in this particular case decided to have this very sort of unconventional way of bringing a witness to see a possible suspect. And Colin actually mentioned to me that, Belina, you had written an article about Trayvon Martin and about eyewitness identification reform. At one point, there's a Geraldo Rivera quote in it saying, "I think the hoodie is as much responsible for Trayvon Martin's death as George Zimmerman was." And I wanted to ask you about that. What was the gist of that article?
But the piece is really about memory and how we create our memories. So for an eyewitness, what are factors that affect even just initial visibility, like in this case, the glasses, but also considering implicit racial bias. And remember, the Trayvon Martin Zimmerman case is where Zimmerman mistook these Skittles and iced tea for a weapon. And, you know, Trayvon Martin's wearing a hoodie, and Rivera blames Trayvon, in a sense, for wearing the hoodie, and that the hoodie is an indicator of criminal behavior, and that he should have avoided it. He shouldn't be wearing the hoodie. But the reality is far more damning. We have these studies that show that African-American faces and bodies can trigger thoughts of crime, and that thinking of crime can trigger thoughts of African-American people. So just through being an African-American male, Trayvon Martin lived with a heightened likelihood of being associated with crime. So these studies go beyond negative sentiments. They go beyond overt discrimination. They show the unconscious impact of racial stereotypes. And we're fortunate that exonerations have proven themselves to be a gateway to recognize racial bias in criminal investigations, to be able to recognize problems of eyewitness misidentification. And in this case, the problem of cross-racial identification, which is huge and has played a factor in a number of DNA exonerations. So that's what that piece is about. And I do have to say thank you to Colin for reviewing that piece when it first came out. He reviewed it on his Evidence Prof blog. So thank you very much for that. And I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk about it again.
Yeah, he sends me notes usually before we do these things. He also wants me to talk about a Supreme Court case, Neal versus Biggers. I was going to toss that out as though I just knew it off the top of my head. but I am not going to do that at this point. But I did want to ask you actually more specifically about the Ronnie Long case. I have to feel like that came into effect on this particular thing. I mean, it's such a strange set of circumstances for a woman to be brought in, clandestinely, literally in disguise. I mean, so much about that is problematic. And plus, anytime anybody's in a court scenario, you imagine the worst. I mean, if this is I don't know if she was able to hear the basics of the case that was being made against Ronnie Long at that moment. I mean,
The episode.
Yeah.
The victim.
I don't know if Judy Boss was able to hear.
Oh, good point.
It sounded like it was like an arraignment, in which case I don't know that any kind of real evidence would be mentioned. But still, if it's trespassing and you've had somebody, you've experienced a home invasion, well, that's the most extreme form of trespassing possible. The many ways that could affect somebody's perception of him as a suspect, it's crazy. But what were your thoughts about it, Belina?
Oh my gosh, I agreed with so many of the people you had on the episode. I mean, the terror the victim must have felt going into that courtroom and feeling a need to disguise herself and being encouraged by the police to disguise herself so that she wouldn't be recognized and just sitting there waiting for hours. And again, this sense that the perpetrator is going to be here, And then, she's looking for, as Ronnie pointed out, a young Black man. And how many young Black men are there in the courtroom, period? So the fact that it narrowed down to essentially him, it sounded like, who else was she going to pick? And we often see eyewitnesses in this situation where they do feel compelled to pick someone, that the true perpetrator must be here. That's why the instruction by police that the perpetrator may not be in this lineup, that we're going to continue working on this case regardless of your answer. Those instructions are so important to eyewitnesses so that they really can impartially look at the pictures and make an identification. I find this very troubling. And then the follow-up identification, of course, where she's shown a lineup of photos where he's the only one who has on a jacket, let alone a Black leather jacket. And she's essentially identifying the person she just saw in the courtroom, not necessarily her going back to her original memory of the perpetrator and of the incident.
Yeah, John, I didn't get to play this in the episode because I don't think I recorded the interview with Ronnie until after we had put the episode together. But you might recall that in the episode, Judy Boss says, "I hear him speaking to the judge, and it sounds like the man who assaulted me." So certainly she could hear that conversation. And they were discussing this trespassing charge, and they were discussing the nature of the evidence against him. And I might weave this into a later episode. What happens is, it is, I think, the park ranger, someone connected to the park, is explaining the state's case and is saying, "I didn't see Ronnie Long in the park." And at that point, the judge looks over to the two officers who basically told her to come to court to say what they saw. And so she would have seen from her position in the courtroom them conferring with the two men who have said, "Come to court. We think the person who assaulted you might be there." And so that's a whole different layer where you can imagine this victim in the case seeing this and thinking, "Oh, well, this must be the person they told me to come in to see." Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a better way to find them. Something better than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter knew there was a smarter way, so they built a platform that finds the right job candidates for you. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. These invitations have revolutionized how you find your next hire. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate to the site in just one day. And ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the strongest applications you receive so you never miss a great match. The right candidates are out there, and ZipRecruiter is how you find them. Businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. That's ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
You mentioned that the Supreme Court case that I mentioned earlier, Neal versus Biggers, that I'm just tossing off the top of my head that I'm completely familiar with. but you mentioned that there was an unusual form of eyewitness identification in that case as well. What was it?
Yeah, so this is a case. This was also an assault similar to the facts in this case. And basically, the suspect looked a bit unusual. So he was a teenager. He was about 5'10" to 6 feet tall. He had a dark brown complexion, and he had the description of the victim was that he was fat and flabby with smooth skin, bushy hair, and a youthful voice. And so this is a case where they told the victim to come down to the police station and said, "The person who assaulted you might be here." The problem is they sort of go into the different jails and the city juvenile halls and try to find someone who looks kind of similar to the suspect so they can have a traditional lineup. They don't find anyone. And so in essence, they just have this victim come in with the suspect they have this suspect say to the victim, "Shut up or I'll kill you," which is what the person said to the victim. And she makes an identification based upon that show up. And so it's sort of similar to the Ronnie Long case where it was a very unorthodox procedure that the Supreme Court was reviewing there.
And where did the Supreme Court come down on it?
I think they allowed it, right, Felina? That's that they found it did not violate the Constitution.
I'm surprised.
This is, I think, mainly, if I'm remembering correctly, Felina, this is, they say, even though this procedure was unorthodox, that during the actual crime itself, the victim had a good chance to see the assailant. And based upon her opportunity at the time of the crime to see the assailant, that overcame any issues that were connected to the suggestive identification procedure.
And made it reliable. And of course, there's been so much science since Neal versus Biggers and Manson versus Brathwaite to challenge the Supreme Court's ongoing holdings that there aren't problems with eyewitness identifications.
Well, I do wonder do we have to just basically wait for that kind of information? I mean, when a scientific study comes out, you know, it's a scientific study. So it usually has some, there are people that try to use that to get legislation changed. Would that be a much more effective route than taking Supreme Court cases, which I imagine they're not engineered to make decisions about things that are scientifically debatable? Is that correct?
Well, interesting thing on that is, Valina, do you want to share the LeVon Brooks case that you mentioned before, sort of the forensic evidence there, because I think that ties into some of everything that's going on. There's a book out. There was this President's Counsel report, but this is like about bite mark evidence, which is a huge issue out there now. So yeah, if you wanted to share what happened in the LaVon Brooks case.
Sure. So Kenny Brewer and LaVon Brooks were both convicted in a small rural county in Mississippi of abducting a young, around 3-year-old African-American girl and sexually assaulting the girl and then murdering the girl and discarding the body. So the same crime, the same, or I should say the same type of crime, but 3 years apart in time. So when the first little girl was murdered, Kenny Brewer was arrested and charged and convicted and got the death penalty. And everyone thought they got it right. And then just a few years later, the same thing happens in this small community. Well, they know it can't be Kenny Brewer because he's on death row. So they arrest LaVon Brooks, charge him, convict him, and he gets a life sentence. Ultimately, DNA evidence is able to show that a third person who was actually on the police list of suspects for both cases, that a third person committed both crimes. So what had led to LaVon and Kenny going to prison in the first place? It was this testimony by Dr. West and Dr. Stephen Hain. Dr. Stephen Hain was a medical examiner. Even though he never was able to pass the licensing boards to actually be a medical examiner, he was the state's head medical examiner for Mississippi for years. And then Dr. West was a dentist who fashioned himself to be a forensic odontologist. So he would determine whether there were bite marks at crime scenes and by looking at these autopsies with Dr. Hain. So Dr. West found multiple bite marks. In fact, he says in Kenny Brewer's case, there were so many bite marks that we stopped counting. That's how many bite marks there were in the case. The bite marks are also only the top of the teeth. It's not even the full mouth imprint that he's finding. He's just saying he's repeatedly finding the top of the teeth and that's a bite mark repeatedly. So this is the evidence, the scientific evidence that was allowed into the courtroom and was allowed to convict LaVon Brooks and Kenny Brewer. When Dr. West's bite mark testimony was later challenged, the Mississippi Supreme Court said, oh, here are these affidavits showing that Dr. West has been wrong in some of these other cases. But, you know, without more, there's nothing to say he was wrong in this case. This isn't sufficient that he's provided false testimony on bite marks in other cases. That's not enough to show that he gave false testimony in this case. So ultimately, fortunately, the DNA evidence was able to free LaVon and free Kenny. But bite mark evidence still continues to be admitted in courts around the country. And I believe to date has not been excluded by any court, state or federal. And this goes back to a very sad cycle of following precedent, where if a scientific discipline like forensic odontology has been generally accepted by courts in West Virginia, we'll say, then the standard is for them to generally be accepted. And challenges can be brought to the individual expert, but we accept forensic odontology as a scientific field in general. The really upsetting thing about this is not just that bite mark evidence is bogus and continues to be further undermined, but it's that the original case out of Wisconsin that so many of these courts, these state courts, relied on to initially admit bite mark evidence and say, okay, we accept forensic odontology as a field. The original case was actually a wrongful conviction.
So oh, I'm sorry, I'm laughing, but they
keep,
that's crazy.
I know, the precedent they keep relying on and keep citing to, that person wasn't guilty and the bite mark evidence was false. So that's the horrible cycle we're in with scientific evidence right now.
Yeah, and John, there's a new book out. It's The Cadaver King and the Country Dentist, A True Story of Injustice in the American South. It's by Radley Belko. And then I assume, Valina, your former colleague at Mississippi, the Innocence Project of Tucker Carrington, they wrote it together. And it's all about this case and forensic bite mark analysis. And yeah, I mean, it's really seen as junk science for many of the reasons that Felina just noted, and it's still used in many jurisdictions across the country.
I would be a little dubious about a doctor who said there were so many bite marks, I didn't bother to count them all, or I stopped counting. Because it's, I would imagine in that situation, it's literally his job to count them.
Yes.
So, well, and they ultimately found that they were bite marks from the girl's body had been in a lake, and that's where they had found the body. And so they were insect bites.
Oh, and I have been very remiss because I have not introduced yet another guest we have. Rebecca Lavoie is here, ladies and gentlemen. She is a noted true crime writer. She's the host of her own podcast, Crime Writers On, as well as a producer of Undisclosed. Welcome to the show, Rebecca.
Thanks, John. It's really fun to be on this side of the microphone.
Yeah, the outside.
Exactly.
Basically, it sounded like you were chomping at the bit to talk about another Supreme Court case that was happening up in New Hampshire. Did you want to chime in on that?
Yeah, there's actually a case that involves a defendant in New Hampshire. This is Perry versus New Hampshire. And the facts of the case are basically that there was an eyewitness identification that involved a woman who was the victim of a crime, I believe it was a burglary. And she then was asked to identify a suspect who was outside, handcuffed, and surrounded by police officers. And so she made the ID. You know, the police said, "Is this your guy?" And she basically said yes. But then later, she couldn't describe the suspect. She couldn't pick him out of a photo array. And then, you know, interestingly enough, the Supreme Court actually, when the case made it to the Supreme Court actually did not rule in Perry's favor, that this was an unfair process for the, and the identification did not, you know, hurt him at trial. And what I always think is super interesting about this opinion is who wrote it. It was written by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Clarence Thomas actually joined in on the majority here. But I lean in my opinion about the case toward the dissent, as we've sort of talked about earlier. The act of suggestion creates due process problems, right? It's not just the, you know, what the cops did, it's the effect of that act. And that's kind of what Sotomayor said in her dissent, that the court's ruling draws a distinction between suggestive conduct and inadvertent suggestive conduct, and either one of those can be unfair. And it kind of goes back to the science, right? I mean, you think about what people see and their bias and perceptions, as we were talking about earlier. You know, the other thing it makes me think of is another story from New Hampshire, the Pam Smart case, right? So there's a lot of data that shows that when people are asked about the Pam Smart case, the facts of the case that they recall are actually the facts of the movie To Die For, starring Nicole Kidman, which is a fictionalized movie version based on the Pam Smart case. And imagine if Pam Smart today had an appeal or a new trial in front of a jury. A lot of people think that that jury pool could be tainted by this fictionalized film that came after, long after her case was settled. So it's that inadvertent process that can have an effect, and it's unfair. I mean, I think that, frankly, as someone who's been writing about true crime for a long time as a journalist, it's very, very hard to understand what the majority was thinking in that particular case.
Again, pop culture has such an effect on these things. I mean, I can see why, you know, your sort of expectation of a cop bringing a suspect before you and saying, "Is this the guy?" And you're saying, "Yeah, that's the guy."
Who else would they bring, right?
Exactly.
Right, right.
And we see it all the time on Law and Order, you know, like Briscoe hauls somebody in front of somebody and it's like, oh, if Briscoe's got him, he's got to be the bad guy, right?
Exactly. Exactly. So I do wonder how those decisions get made. I mean, it seems like, you know, you don't want to handcuff police detectives and say that their judgment on, you know, like, let's say they just caught a perpetrator who just stole somebody's purse, you know, or they think stole somebody's purse. And they say, "Was this the guy who stole your purse?" You know, and she says, "Yeah, that's the guy who stole my purse." You know, that is requiring them to get the guy, take him to the station, you know, put him in a lineup, all those procedures seem onerous to, you know, to a layman, I would imagine.
Well, not if it becomes the law. I mean, New Hampshire may actually take some corrective action here. The newsroom that I work in, we report a lot on politics and policy in the State House. And I happen to know that there is a bill at the New Hampshire State House. It's HB 1329. It would mandate law enforcement agencies adopt new policies around eyewitness ID in order to prevent this exact kind of situation. It was passed by the New Hampshire House. It's been amended. It's now it's in Senate committee. So we're kind of waiting to see. But basically, you know, this is how things are in other countries. If you look at the British policing system, for instance, they have an entirely different sort of process and a ton of procedure around how IDs are made, around how people are questioned, about how evidence is disclosed. And it's very, you know, it's arguable in different parts of the process that it's not, but it's very defendant. It sort of has those protections built in, and that's just the process. And as we know from looking at corrupt police departments, if you see all the stories out of Baltimore, it's not that some cop, you know, or Philadelphia, the case we've been hearing about Undisclosed, it's not that that cop wakes up in the morning and thinks, like, how can I screw people today, right? It's that this is just how they do it. This is how they do their job. This is how they learned how to do their job. And this is how the department does their job. And this is how all his colleagues do their jobs. This is how he does his job. Now, imagine if just the way you do the job is just different because that's the law and that everyone is trained that way and that your cases don't come together if you don't do it that way. Then the cops start doing it that way. I mean, that's how we've seen other things work that have, you know, been successful reforms. But it does very often take that kind of, you know, actual legislation. You can't just trust that people will buck everything they've been taught and everything their colleagues are doing just because it feels wrong on a particular day.
Yeah, and that New Hampshire proposal is largely based on the North Carolina law that Jennifer Thompson, who you heard from the episode, lobbied for so hard over many years. And so that's great in New Hampshire. I really hope that passes and does allow for that reform.
What's the eyewitness identification procedure in South Carolina, where you are, Colin?
It varies. We don't have any type of statewide law. There are certain jurisdictions that do have sequential lineups and double blind lineups where it's not the officer who knows who the suspect is who's conducting it. But it is really hit and miss. In some jurisdictions, it's a lot worse than that. And there are these subjective procedures. And there's South Carolina case law, namely a case named Green, that says that those procedures are constitutional. And sort of as Rebecca was saying, it's scattershot. And there's nothing uniform that makes it have these hallmarks of reliability.
I think there are more and more states, though, that are looking at standardizing this through making it code, through passing legislation. And I know in West Virginia, we were able to pass a bill a couple of years ago that does require each office to have a written policy for how they conduct photo lineups and live lineups and show ups. The police are required to get a complete description of the perpetrator before the lineup. So looking into those estimator variables and the instructions that we talked about earlier, that the police are required to say that the perpetrator may or may not be present, that the victim is not required to make an identification, that it's important to exclude innocent people, and that the investigation will continue no matter what. So it's actually in our code now that the police are not supposed to say anything to specifically influence the witness, that the process should be double blind unless that's an undue burden, and that show-ups are really discouraged. And I know, John, you mentioned show-ups earlier, and doesn't that seem so easy, but in our statute now, it says that show-ups are only allowed in exigent circumstances that require this immediate display of the suspect. Otherwise, you have to follow the procedure and the protocol. Take them back to the station.
Well, it seemed like the cops in this particular case, in the Ronnie Long case, were really on top of it in terms of the investigation. I mean, the first officer arrived within 15 seconds of him receiving the call. I mean, that's an astonishing response time. And then it sounded like the crime scene was processed. They got a footprint. They, you know, it sounded as though the officers in this particular case were really on top of the case and were being very diligent. It sort of all the more brings into question why the really odd, you know, especially when they've made it clear they do photo arrays, you know, why suddenly go out of the box and do this odd court-based identification? It's very strange given the rest of their behavior.
Right. And yeah, why take this intermediate step? Obviously, After the in-court identification, they have the photo array, and after she's picked him out in the courtroom, she does it in the photo array. And that's a huge question we have in this case, is why they did this intermediate step. Why not go directly to the photo array as opposed to this unorthodox procedure? And you can ascribe all sorts of, on the one hand, bad motives, and on the other hand, maybe this was what they thought was the best way to do it. But certainly, as the experts said in the episode, and as we've come to believe, and based upon other cases involving similar procedures, this is one of those cases where there's every reason to doubt this in-court identification.
It's just bizarre. I mean, I hear the story, and it's like, not only is it a bizarre way to, you know, ask for someone to identify a suspect, it's also a rape victim. We're not talking about a victim of a, you know, pickpocket. You're talking about somebody whose home was invaded, who was violently raped at knife point. Obviously, you know, I think even back then, the concept of trauma would probably be like a familiar one, right? And the idea that we're going to take you into a situation, you're not going to know what's going to happen. You're going to have to wear this stupid disguise and tell us what you, I mean, it's insane. It's completely insane.
Well, you don't know that it was stupid. She might have looked fantastic.
That's true. That's true. That's an excellent point.
Let's not. But now, Valina, so you're an ADA. I mean, why would they hesitate to bring him in for a lineup for some reason?
I agree. This seems absolutely ludicrous. I mean, and I don't think it would be something that would happen today. I have to think this is a product of its time. I mean, this case being 41 years old, because this is just, it's ludicrous. This would be called out. I really think that a defense attorney would call out this type of identification as unreliable, and that it wouldn't be able to be brought into the courtroom today.
I actually had a question about the defense attorney in this case, being that when they brought Ms. Bost in, as she was wearing prescription glasses that she didn't normally wear, did the defense attorney ever bring that up in the trial, that when she actually first identified him, she was wearing glasses that she didn't normally wear?
They didn't. And I really wish they did, because that's a research topic I've been trying to track down. If she's required for her driver's license to wear glasses, that means she must be at least significantly nearsighted. And yet she mentions it during direct examination that she was wearing these glasses she had to wear while driving and wasn't wearing them at the time of the assault. But there's no discussion of how bad her vision is, how that might have impacted the identification. So yeah, that's a question mark, and it wasn't addressed at trial other than her own testimony on direct that she was wearing these glasses.
Yes, I figured that would be my Cousin Vinny moment that you would highlight, Colin, being that your pop culture references are always on point. Did the shoe print that was lifted from the scene match any shoes that Ronnie owned? Did they try that or go down that route at all?
Yeah, this is something we will cover in both the trial and the appeal. So there was testimony at trial about the shoe print, testimony about the shoes that Ronnie Long had at the time, and there was a report connected to the shoe print that was not disclosed to the defense at the time of trial, was not disclosed until over 30 years after trial, and that is a big part of Ronnie Long's current appeal.
And at the time, this is 1976, so did they even make attempts to retrieve DNA samples? I mean, was there any attempt in that respect?
Yeah, and so that's another thing we'll cover both in the trial and the appeal. There was, in fact, a rape kit that was done of the victim, and there are questions surrounding that rape kit, which were not resolved at a trial, and in fact are still seeking resolution at this point in time.
So here's a question for Valina. Okay, so the physical characteristics she described, Mrs. Bost described, did not really match up to Ronnie Long, the person convicted of the crime. You know, and being that we're seeing eyewitness identifications are going pretty far afield, is that something that's really common, that the convicted person will not match that first description given by the eyewitness?
I mean, I don't know if I can speak to that. What I can say is that an initial identification will often be reaffirmed by a later identification or feedback from the police, to the point where once you get to trial, the victim is 100% certain that the person I identified is the perpetrator and is that person who's sitting at defense counsel's table. This is why it's so important to get a statement, a confident statement from the witness at the time of the first identification, so that in that moment when the memory is freshest for the eyewitness, how confident are they? Are they 50% confident? Are they not certain? Because by the time they get to trial, it's going to likely be 100% confidence.
I've got a question about that discrepancy. And, you know, full disclosure, when I get the files, the audio files to put these undisclosed episodes together, sometimes I hear conversations that, you know, like Susan and Colin and Rabia will have that are just sort of offline conversations. They don't make it into the podcast. And Susan actually asked Colin the same question I had when I heard this, which was the accent question, because the victim here describes her assailant as not having an accent, but then they arrested Ronnie Long. And as Colin, as you pointed out, he does have an accent, so much so that, you know, just even it's not just the fuzzy phone line. Sometimes he's a little bit difficult to understand when he's talking. Did the victim have the same kind of accent that Ronnie Long had? And that's why she didn't recognize him having an accent. I mean, is there any way to know, you know, what she would characterize as an accent or not an accent? Because clearly he has one.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I'm not sure if there's any sort of expert research into this subject. All I can sort of rely on is interacting with people here in Columbia, South Carolina, which, again, isn't too far from Concord. And what I've tended to find in talking to people is that people with an accent are able to recognize that other people have sort of the Columbia accent. So I have a colleague, for instance, who's from the South, and the word L-E-N-G-T-H, length, you know, she pronounces it length, and is aware of other people when they say something similar. Oh, that person has an accent because, yeah, I know they say words like length instead of length. And so I don't know. It's tough to say whether there's anything scientific to that. But my sense in talking to people is that even if you have an accent, you can recognize others with an accent. But I can recognize that other people might say, well, no, if you have that accent, then someone not from that area appears to have an accent. The question that was asked to her was, did the assailant have any noticeable accent, brogue, or speech defect? And her answer is a clear no. There was no accent, brogue, or speech defect.
Hmm. Yeah, because I also found him a little bit difficult to understand in the podcast because of his accent.
Yeah, we got several listeners who said the same thing.
Now, I had a question about fillers. What is the criteria for fillers? Because as Valina, you pointed out, there was that one case where they couldn't find somebody who was, I guess, flabby enough or whatever. Do they go by the particulars of the description? Like if somebody says, okay, he was Caucasian, you know, stocky and had incredibly short legs. Well, you know, then that's pretty clear. Their mandate is clear, but they're, you know, as you know, with humanity, there's an enormous range of people that are actually within that criteria. Do they go by just the particulars of the description, or, you know, I just don't know how they judge.
Right. Well, it's a lot simpler nowadays that there are so many mass photos of people, and that at least in West Virginia, they're often photo lineups. They're not live lineups. So the photo arrays makes it a simpler process. But as to what should the characteristics be, it's really important that the fillers match the victim's description of the suspect. So not necessarily just matching who they think the perpetrator is, but also what did the victim say about what the suspect looked like. You want the fillers to resemble the suspect. I mean, here it seemed like there was different clothing, different physical appearance. Maybe even there was a woman in the lineup, maybe. So these are all huge variables that should be easily eliminated. So you want people who are going to resemble the suspect as well. And you have to make sure there's only one suspect in the photo array. If you don't have it limited to just one suspect, then you're not going to know the accuracy. If you just have eight suspects and you put them all in there, then the victim's going to be right no matter who she picks, because she's picking a suspect no matter who. She's never going to pick a filler. So it's really important that it be all fillers and then the one suspect. And generally, it's between 6 and 8 photos that you would have. So you would have a large number of fillers as well. But they have to look similar to the suspect. Not identical, but similar enough that it really requires some memory on the part of the victim.
Got it. So it's around the suspect. You're using the suspect as part of the criteria because you're trying to find fillers who look similar.
Well, you really want to go off of the victim's identification of what the person looks like, but you have to make sure that those fillers look like the suspect so that the suspect isn't standing out because he's the only one who looks the way he does.
Yeah, and John, in terms of North Carolina's new role that Jennifer Thompson had fought for, it says, I'm quoting from it, all fillers selected shall resemble as much as practicable the eyewitness's description of the perpetrator and significant features, including any unique or unusual features. So that's sort of the criteria that they apply in North Carolina now.
And in terms of like actual physical lineups, how do they find the fillers for that? Or do they just pull, you know, Dave from accounting?
I've always wanted to know that. I've always wondered that. I'm so glad you asked that question.
I think it's really difficult in states like West Virginia, where you have very small offices. It's very difficult to find people because you're not going to have a jail of folks that are just local and right there that you could pull from. But we've also heard of people who've been wrongfully convicted who just volunteered for lineups, right? Who just volunteered to be part of it, and then they were picked. So.
So I wanted to get to something that that we haven't actually gotten to on Undisclosed, but apparently it's been part of some of the appeals that you've been dealing with at the Innocence Project, which is shaken baby syndrome, which apparently there's a lot of, you know, a lot of science is being brought to bear on that. But could you tell us a little bit about the history of it, and both as a prosecutable offense and as a what's now turning into a defense instead? Could you tell us about that?
Sure. So shaken baby syndrome is a medical theory. It's a medical hypothesis that if you shake a child severely enough, the child will have bleeding in the brain, swelling of the brain, and bleeding in the eyes. And those three factors are known as the triad. So again, swelling of the brain, bleeding of the brain, and bleeding in the eyes. And for decades, doctors, when a child would come into the hospital presenting those three elements of the triad, just those three factors, the doctor would immediately say, this is abuse, this is shaken baby syndrome, this child has been shaken to cause these injuries. And when we say shaken, the testimony is repeatedly that it's shaking the same as the impact of a car crash or the child falling out of a four-story window. So this is tremendous impact. And from that, you know, vigorous shaking, the diagnosis itself then becomes a charge. So the medical diagnosis itself contains the crime, shaking, contains the intent that had to have been intentional for it to be that damaging. And ultimately, justice diagnosis is used to support these charges and these convictions. The really sad thing is that doctors haven't been looking at alternative explanations, differential diagnoses. We now have research that shows that even a short fall of a child, a couple of feet, can cause those same injuries in the brain, that other kinds of impact can cause injury in the brain, that rickets can cause a couple of these, that even just lack of oxygen can lead to bleeding in the eyes, for example, and the brain swelling. So there are all these other potential causes for this triad that is incredibly limiting to say that when a child comes in with these three factors, we know that it's abuse. It's incredibly limited. And now doctors are aware that they need to do a differential diagnosis and that they need to know the history of the child. Was the child having a seizure? Was the child witnessed in a shortfall? That there needs to be a greater examination of the child's health before jumping straight to an allegation of violent behavior against the child. And you're right. We're seeing a lot of these shaken baby cases. You're right.
It actually, what you're really speaking to is something that is kind of a larger theme. I mean, there's a reason why there aren't a ton of true crime podcasts about women defendants. So, you know, the fact that like wrongfully convicted women There are technical reasons for it, too, which is that like a lot of cases with women in prison don't involve DNA, which I know is a criteria for a lot of Innocence Project work. But there's also this, as you mentioned, sort of writing into accusations against women. I think of people like Amy Fisher and, you know, Susan Smith and Jodi Arias and, you know, even Pam Smart, who we talked about, you know, the public persona on them. Put upon them from the moment of arrest. And then like in the media, they often have names like Killer Mom, right? Long Island Lolita. It's like sort of the negative branding of women who commit crimes. It's like there's first of all the sexist idea that like women are supposed to be better or something. But then there's also this idea that when women commit crimes or are suspected of crimes, it's so much worse and there's evil at work. And it, just look at the branding around true crime television. Look at Discovery ID and the artwork on some of those shows, Wives with Knives, Killer Vixens, and understand that there is this sort of societal perception of women defendants, women who are arrested, women who are suspects, that begins at that moment. You talked about the doctor naming the diagnosis with a crime in the name. I mean, it's a real problem. And when you look at the statistics of women who are actually in prison, I know here in New Hampshire, the statistics are grim. And these sort of sensational crimes that put women away for life, the reality is that like 90% of women in prison are in prison because they're at some point themselves were victims of abuse or trauma or addiction. And, you know, these other stories where, you know, this sort of branding is put on women and the, you know, the shaken baby syndrome, the sudden infant death syndrome, the, you know, all of these syndromes that have been created that sort of in some way blame, you know, women differently than men. It's a really interesting phenomenon. And I think it's one of the reasons why we don't see popular stories emerge, you know, around wrongful convictions of women.
I absolutely agree with Rebecca. And going back to the SIDS diagnosis, I mean, we look at, you know, the 1850s and the latter half of that century where it was bondswomen and immigrant women, poor women, who were being charged with smothering children. And we now know that that's SIDS, but it's this vulnerable population that would be specifically charged with this heinous crime that how can you even imagine a woman doing this? And so the woman becomes even more of an other who can be judged. You know, women aren't generally like this, but this horrible monster of a person was able to do this. I completely agree with what Rebecca is saying.
Yeah, it's sort of a wolf in sheep's clothing sort of cliche. The idea is that men, you expect to be savages, but women are, you know, all sweetness and light. And thus, you know, we are betrayed when they commit some crime. But now I had heard a statistic that most of the women claiming wrongful conviction were cases where it had been harm to a child that put them in that situation. Is that a fair representation?
Well, I don't know if that's accurate. I do know that most of the cases involve a family member, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's a child. The shaken baby syndrome cases, the person who is alleged to have done the shaking is the person who was last alone with the child. So it often is the female caretaker.
And Colin, my understanding is our next undisclosed series is our first one involving a woman wrongly convicted.
Yeah, well, following up on what was just discussed, yeah, this is the Pamela Lanier case out of North Carolina. And there actually is an investigation discovery episode of the series Deadly Women on her case. And it's quite salacious the way they present it. And we're going to dig into that case. She was accused of killing her husband. This is one of two famous cases invoking the doctrine of chances in North Carolina. The other is the Michael Peterson case that was documented in the Staircase. And so this series, we're going to look into that doctrine of chances, the facts surrounding the death of the husband, and some new evidence that might lead to a new trial for her.
Was there an owl involved in the case you're going to be covering?
There was no owl, but there were turkey farmers, and
really?
That's a big part of the case.
Huh, yes. Very interesting.
I have to say, I was innocent of the fact that there was a show called Wives with Knives.
Oh, yes.
That is new information.
I'm sorry to ruin it for you, but there is. And all of these shows, you know, I've actually been on some of these shows, and I've talked about this in my own podcast. There's something that happens. I mean, the books that I write with my husband, Kevin Flynn, they're pretty straight reporting, right? We don't make them sensational. We're both journalists. We basically talk about the facts of the case, you know, what happened at trial, the police detective work, the defense, the offense, all that stuff. And then we're asked to talk about the case that we wrote about factually. when these producers come to town to film these shows. And then when you watch them, like, I could just be saying something like really straightforward, like, and then so-and-so went to the market and filled a plastic bag of groceries. And in the background, they'll use my voice over, you know, reenactment of a woman wearing lingerie, like pushing a shopping cart. And it's like, this is the problem, right? Is that, you know, every woman suspected of murder has to be a temptress. It's really gross. And I kind of blame like the Nancy Grace culture of true crime reporting on that particular trend. And, you know, and the fact that like women are largely the audience for this, too, is ironic and interesting. But it's something that I'm really hoping that Undisclosed. I mean, I hope that's something specifically that you guys get to talk about is, you know, the fact that these cases where it really is in doubt just don't come to light a whole lot when there's a woman involved.
Yes, that's the plan.
And another case that we're going to be doing on Undisclosed comes from the West Virginia Innocence Project? Is that right, Belina?
Yeah, the West Virginia Innocence Project. Yeah, Ricky Holly's case. And I'm really excited Undisclosed is investigating it and looking into it. The police could never prove where the victim was killed, when she was killed, what the weapon was used to kill her, and just went with the first target they could, which was her estranged husband, Rick Holly. And this is a case that's 20 years old.
We've found that the 90s produced a remarkable number of wrongful convictions, and we've gone into some depth about exactly what we think caused that. But it makes it all the more remarkable when there are people who get out after, you know, say 10 years. I'm still amazed given the normal amount of time these things have to take through the justice system. There's another case from the West Virginia Innocence Project, the Justin Keith Black case that was recently in the news. Could you tell us a little bit about that, Polina?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So that's a case of four men, Justin Black, brothers Nathan and Philip Barnett, and then a fourth individual, Mr. Dement. So these four men were arrested and convicted of a murder 5 years after the murder had happened, and essentially based on the false confession of that fourth person, Mr. Dement. Mr. Dement created a fantastical story about the four of them taking a woman from a party deep into the woods and murdering her. And he recanted multiple times. He has his own mental health struggles and drug addiction struggles and went back and forth repeatedly. Finally, we now have DNA evidence. We finally have DNA evidence that excludes all four of them, including Mr. Dement himself, and also inculpates the true perpetrator. So we were able to get a hit through CODIS, and the true perpetrator is incarcerated right now for another violent crime. So we were able, the Exoneration Project, the Innocence Project, and the West Virginia Innocence Project, to file a petition for relief, and we're hopeful that the court will rule on it.
So Justin Keith Black is still in jail?
Yes. Yes, he is.
How long has that been?
The original conviction would have been 2005, I believe. So over 10 years. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, it brings me to Colin's been working on a bill in South Carolina to provide for compensation for people who've been wrongfully convicted. Well, where is that at, Colin?
Yes, this is currently in the House Committee on Judiciary in South Carolina. It is House Bill 4838. It is asking for South Carolina to join the 32 states, D.C., and the federal government in having a mechanism that allows for the wrongfully convicted who have proven their innocence to receive compensation for the years that they spent in prison. And so any South Carolina listeners, if you could call your state representatives, we need a vote in the Judiciary Committee by April 1st. Again, it's House Bill 4838, and it's seeking to compensate the wrongfully convicted.
Well, does it set a sort of schedule of how to compensate them? I mean, does it just leave it up to judges? Does it set an amount of time for amount of years? I mean, how would the mechanism of that work?
It is $15,000 per year of wrongful conviction. I wish we could have had more in the bill, but, you know, it's tough to get consensus here in South Carolina. And I think the thinking of the representatives who wrote the bill was this is something that'll be palatable for both sides of the political spectrum. So $15,000 per year. The burden of proof is clear and convincing evidence. It does not require a pardon by the governor, which some states like Maryland have. It really is a fairly straightforward, streamlined process where if a person is found to be wrongfully convicted, they should be able to recover in pretty short fashion.
Colin, is there a cap on the number of years you can be compensated for?
There is a cap. The cap is $50,000, which, again, I wish it could be higher, but in the interest of trying to get consensus, we thought this is something that has a chance of passage, whereas if it were higher, it would not really have a chance of passing.
Wow. So people will really only be compensated for 3.5 years.
Right. And if we compare that to North Carolina, if Ronnie Long is released, the cap there is $750,000, and that's $50,000 a year. So, you know, obviously there are differences. New Hampshire has a law, and they are on the low end, even lower than South Carolina's proposal. There are some states that are in between. It's something where it's definitely a compromise effort we're trying to get past.
But now, Belina, you've actually had some exonerees come out. Have you had any of them actually, you know, try to get this from the government?
Well, I applaud Colin and the South Carolina legislature for trying to get something passed because we have nothing in West Virginia. So we do not have a compensation statute in West Virginia. We do have a court of claims where you can file a claim for having been wrongfully incarcerated. So there is that option, but there is no guarantee or commitment by the state to look out for people who have been wrongfully convicted.
Well, could somebody just sue in the hope that a court would find their favor?
Yes. And that's really the impetus for legislatures to pass these statutes is we see lawsuits where individuals are able to get upwards of $1 million for the trauma they've gone through, for the misbehavior of law enforcement or prosecutors. So it should protect the state from those kinds of lawsuits by having a bill that provides compensation. The sad thing I found is that it's a really high burden to be able to win one of those cases where you're saying that there was misconduct by law enforcement, that there was misconduct by the state, and to win a claim where you would have such a lucrative lawsuit amount. So the compensation statutes really can help people who aren't going to win those big lawsuits, but it can get them back on their feet again.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because the statute would actually limit the state's liability. So that's in some way making it attractive for them to deal with it.
Yeah, in some senses, it's fiscally conservative, definitely.
Well, I've got some listener questions that I'd love to get to. We've got one from Liz Schuster who says, it's a bit tangential, but I can't be the only one who was temporarily confused about why he was wearing a sled on his head before realizing that a toboggan must be some sort of hat. But this goes to the regionalism aspect. And a lot of people, by the way, also had the same question about the accent that you had, Rebecca, which is to a person who has an accent, do they perceive that somebody has an accent? No. Yes, I was innocent of the toboggan term myself. But my understanding is it's a knit cap, correct?
Right. Yeah, knit ski cap, basically.
Okay. Well, we cleared that up. Phew. Okay. We got this from Danielle, who says, why is Ronnie's sentence so long? Is that normal given the nature of the crime in North Carolina, or was it a race issue? It just seems excessive.
Yeah, we're going to go into detail on this in episode 2, premiering next Monday. The interesting thing is that at the time Ronnie was charged, if convicted, he would have been given a mandatory death sentence. And luckily for him, that was changed in the summer of 1976 to a mandatory life sentence, which is the sentence he was eventually given. So, yes, it does have racial origins. It goes all the way back to the antebellum South, and we'll cover that in more detail in episode 2.
We got this from the Pod Sheep NZ, who says it's way too early to be thinking of alternate suspects, I know, but the victim's description of yellow skin has really stuck with me. Is it possible that it was due to a medical condition that could help identify the person? Long shot, I know, but what the hell?
You know what I think it was? I think it was a touch of racism there, frankly. I mean, this victim was a victim, obviously, but there was some other content there that indicated that perhaps she didn't have a broad vocabulary when it came to describing African-American people. I don't know, Colin, is that just my impression or is that true?
Well, this is something absolutely where she said, admittedly, she did not have much contact with African Americans. She didn't socialize with African Americans, had never been to an African American's house or had an African American at her house. And so certainly this is someone operating with a very limited amount of contact with non-Caucasians.
And yes, my understanding is that there's a lot of terminology regarding the different skin tones, and a lot of people discuss colorism when it comes to people of color. And it sounded to me like yellow was in that spectrum. That's what I understood it to mean. But, you know, obviously I can't speak for the victim in that case.
Right. I mean, obviously she's saying this assailant is light skinned, has yellow skin, and yet is saying, I'm confident that Ronnie Long did it. And so the question then becomes, is she considering Ronnie Long to be light skinned, or is this a case where she has, despite this disparate description, sort of meshed the two together and figured it must have been him based upon this procedure that was used in the case?
We got another question from Jenny, who says, why is it possible that Ronnie Long was convicted largely because of an unusual and not 100% clear identification from one eyewitness? Who makes this decision? And I think it goes to, is it the detectives who make that decision, or is it the district attorneys who make that decision? Who is the one who actually says, okay, that's it, you know, we're going forward with this?
Yeah, well, ultimately, it's the district attorney. And I guess we've seen this now with three recent cases. We saw it with, well, the Willie Vesey case, he did have a confession, we think is false. But certainly the Terrence Lewis case was an identification by one witness. It's the identification here. Yeah, and ultimately, it's the DA, whether they think that they have enough evidence to prove guilt and whether they think they have a strong enough case. And in this case, clearly they did. Although, as we'll see in episode two, there was a fairly favorable plea deal that they offered to Ronnie Long that he turned down before going to trial.
And our last listener question isn't really a question. I just wanted to say it because Kelly Marie Rosnagal says, love your podcast. Thank you for doing what you guys do. You're all very talented and do a great job. I love all the cases you choose, especially those involving juveniles. Fascinating and yet so frustrating at the same time. So just wanted to pass that on.
Thanks, Kelly.
So, Colin, did you have any more questions for Valina?
No, I don't think so. I look forward to working with you, Valina, over the summer and prepping the Ricky Holly case. And I think it'll be something that the listeners will be quite interested in.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. And thanks for letting me be on this. This has been super fun.
Oh, I'm so glad. Nice, and I apologize for the, usually this, it's an incredibly smooth technical experience. Usually I am not literally phoning it in. I have done that before. That has occurred before. This is not the very first time. But thank you guys so much for being here. And I will talk to you guys soon again.
Thank you so much, John.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, everyone.
Well, that is it for our first addendum of this new series. If you feel like checking out our website, it is undisclosed-podcast.com, as you probably knew. There is a list of all of the criminal justice-related charities that you can make donations to there. I am donating my fee for this particular episode to Healing Justice, the organization founded by Jennifer Thompson. You can help them as well at their website, healingjusticeproject.org. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at their handle at UndisclosedPod, and send any questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. Thank you so much for those questions. We love them. And last week, I mentioned that my assistant had kind of dropped the ball, Andrew Congdon, and I now regret that because I threw that in because I figured nobody listens to the credits on these things, but I found out that somebody does. Andrew, my assistant, listens to the credits, and he felt terrible. Andrew is a treasure. I am thoroughly grateful for the work you do. And, you know, please, it was a joke, dude. Okay. But I also want to thank Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media for being on the show and for producing the show once again. And also thank Patrick Cortez, who composed our addenda theme, and Methil Telehan, who is our project manager. Thank you so much for listening. And I can't wait to be back next week.